Hi, team. So, hi. Thank you for coming. For attending our Adults and Health Scrutiny Committee tonight on the 14th. Before we start, can I, before the meeting, can all committee members just confirm they have access to the agenda? Okay, great. Okay, so one will be delayed. Everyone, great, thank you. Okay, so just some fire procedures in-house I need to comment on. In the event of an evacuation alarm sounding, continuous sound, all persons should vacate the building by the nearest available exit, which is down the main stairs and out the back door of the town hall, and proceed directly to the point in front of the cathedral. If the alarm is an intermittent sound, this indicates a lockdown. Hopefully these won't happen, by the way. Attendees should stay in their seats and await further instructions. And thank you for the Senior Democratic Services Officer over here to my left. He's highlighted that we have two new members, Councillor Heather Skipstead and Councillor Lucinda Robinson, whose new members joining us tonight. So thank you very much for that. It's now time for ourselves to introduce each members of the committee. So can we start down with Councillor Elsie, please? Thank you.
Councillor Elsie for the Wittering Ward.
Jackie Allen for East Ward.
Brian Rush, Stanground South.
Chris Harper, Stanground South.
Councillor Lucinda Robinson for Ravensthorpe Ward.
Saqib Farouk for Glinton and Castor Ward.
Ramin Shams, Senior Democratic Service Officer.
It's like a relay, isn't it? Simon, Councillor Barkham, Pastor Walton Chair.
Jyoti Attree, Director of Public Health.
Debbie McCaid, Director of Adults and Safeguarding.
Shabina Kayoum, Councillor for East Ward.
Noreen B, Councillor for North Ward.
Councillor... Councillor Heather Skipstead for Orton Longville Ward.
Eva Woods, Youth MP for Peterborough.
Sandy Burns, Co-opted Member.
Thank you, team. Okay, item one, apologies for absence. Senior Democratic Service Officer Ramin, are there any apologies?
Yes, Chair. We have received apologies from Co-opted Member Chris DeWalt.
Okay, thank you. Item two, declarations of interest and whipping declarations. Are there any, Ramin? No, the committee, my apologies. Any tonight from the members? Nope. Item number three, it's the minutes from the previous meeting, dated the 3rd of January. We need to seek approval for that, so I need a proposer and a seconder. Councillor Harper proposing that? And a seconder. I need a seconder. Okay, Councillor Rush, thank you very, very much. Okay, item four, which is any call-ins. Ramin, have you received any call-ins?
None received, Chair.
Okay, thank you. So we've had a a reorder from of item six, which is now item five. So that's just not a problem, it's absolutely fine. So this is the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services and Adult Mental Health Services. Adele McCormick, Service Director for Adult Specialist Mental Health. If you'd like to introduce this, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Adele McCormack, Service Director for Adult and Specialist. So I'm here on behalf of Debbie Smith, who is our Director of Operations and System Partnerships. So we were asked by the committee to present some key data in specific relation to adult mental health crisis services, child and adolescent mental health services, counselling services and waiting times, and services and management of psychosis. And the commissioning responsibilities for mental health services. So we've provided a report which takes you through the background and the key issues and the data. And I'm happy to, if there's any specific questions around the data that we have provided. Our biggest challenges at the moment with everything is being able to manage the backlog of waiting lists from the COVID pandemic, which is where we have had to pause some services, and we've had to utilise staff in other areas to respond to the pandemic, and also services changed and we had to operate in different ways due to infection prevention and control guidance. All of that has kind of led to a challenge with the workforce. We've got a very tired workforce, and as we know, it's a national problem in terms of being able to retain staff. So we're doing everything possible at the moment to make Cambridgeshire and Peterborough an attractive organisation, and CPFT and an attractive organisation to work for. And we're doing that across the system with our other health colleagues as well. Also, what we're having to focus on is ensuring that the quality of the services, consistently meeting the quality standards. So during COVID, there was CQC sort of were doing very different inspections. They're now inspecting all the services, and we're having to make sure our services are meeting the quality standards. Huge emphasis on staff well-being, so there's a lot of moral injury with our staff, and we're trying to develop a well-led culture within the organisation. Some of the other things that are our challenges, so that the NHS long-term plan, specifically for mental health, has huge amounts of investment and transformation in mental health services, which is quite right. But the challenge is being able to transform and expand at the requirements of the long-term plan, as well as trying to stabilise the services that we've got. There has been a surge in people needing mental health services following the pandemic, so the isolation, job losses, the impact of COVID, bereavement, etc., has meant that the demand for mental health services is greater, and patient acuity is higher. So as we know, people were not seen as much as they were before. They were restricted in their access to things that probably would have kept them well, social networks, all of the things within their communities, and that's had an impact on the acuity of mental health, which has meant that we've got people accessing services for longer periods of time. That's also having an impact on flow and challenge within the system. So we have got a number of golden thread programmes at CPFT where we're looking to work on the waiting times to reduce how long people are waiting for services, and thinking about the patient journey through our health service. So they're the biggest things that we're focusing on at the moment as a trust. And some of the positives is that we have been able to maintain some good standards with some of our key services, which we'll see in the pack. So specifically early intervention and psychosis service, access to the psychological wellbeing service under the IAPT programme. We've all been able to maintain waiting times, good waiting times in those services. And we have developed some good partnerships with the East of England Ambulance Service and with the police, which has had a really positive impact on preventing people being sectioned under a 136 and being taken to an A&E department when they're presenting with a mental health only need. What we have struggled with, so the demand on our first response service, which is our 111 option 2, so that has seen a 44% increase in referrals, which has meant that the waiting time for answering those calls has been impacted significantly.
Thank you, Ms. Carmack. Thank you very much. I'm sure we do have questions for you. So, members. Councillor Allen. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Your last point is really what I would like to come back to, and it's the table at the top of page 17, which shows how the referrals are presenting themselves. I wonder if you could explain the table a bit more, because self-referral is 5,700. Is that individuals, or is that the number? It could be the same person.
That'll be number of calls that were self-referrals, so it could be repeated callers, and we do have people who repeatedly use first response service. So we do have frequent users of the service.
And if it was the frequent user, how would that be dealt with? And just if I could just follow up.
Yeah.
How many of these might be from Peterborough? Do we know that information? Could this table be broken down into some... Mine.
If we're taking the details from the patient, then that would correlate to the NHS spine, so we would be able to identify where the callers had come from. So we would be able to try and see if we can break that down. Obviously, if a caller rings and doesn't leave any information or hangs up, but then we wouldn't necessarily know. But when we get repeated callers, so it's not necessarily a bad thing, because actually that intervention could be the thing that person needs. We will have people that might access 5 or 6 or 7 times to get them through that particular crisis, and that is all that they need, and they then sort of recover and are able to, with the strategies and the help that they're given on the phone, they might find other ways of managing their crisis or come out of that crisis indeed. There are people that functionally use the service, so that we'll use it for longer periods of time. So we are doing some work with our ICB colleagues and some work with Cambridgeshire, Peterborough and South Lincolnshire Mind at looking at identifying some of those individuals and seeing if we can offer additional support to them that will allow them to have their needs met without the need to continually call the phone number.
Happy with that? Turn your microphone if you are going to ask questions.
If the data could be broken down slightly more, I think it would be useful to understand. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to take that as an action.
Thank you. Councillor Robinson.
Thank you. My question relates to page 20, but also in the appendix table 3.8 about ASD and ADHD referrals and the waiting time. So I see that referrals have increased, waits are still very high. And I know here in Peterborough, as a primary school SENCO, that we have a very fixed set of procedures here for early help, parenting workshop, all the evidence that we have to send off that doesn't exist elsewhere in the country. So my question is, have we reviewed if this rather different system, this different pathway here in Peterborough, works? Because I think the intention was to avoid unnecessary referrals in that were swamping the system. And I guess to know if it works, how are our weights comparing nationally?
So I think because I fundamentally work in the adults part, it might be a question I can go away and get some more detail for you specifically. From a mental health perspective, from a policy perspective, ADHD is not included in the mental health investment standard, so it's not something that's invested in at the same rate that other mental health conditions have been invested in. What has become apparent within what we have seen from the impact of COVID is the demand for ADHD and autism has the impact, so it's not that it's created, it's that actually people have struggled more, so actually that they're requiring more support and help. So that definitely has come forward as a national, nationally. But in terms of specifically related to children, I can take that question away and come back with more detail. I'd rather not from a policy perspective, I can tell you that's not it's not featured as an investment priority, so then it ends up being a priority in terms of the whole sort of funding realm of health within the system.
So also on the same theme, I know on page 20 that says, when looked at the reasons for the longest waits, part of it was insufficient information received from the referral. Now, I know it's an incredibly long form with about 6 attachments that we have to put on. So I'm quite surprised by that, but I just wondered if you know if this is being addressed. Are referrers being supported with any CPD so that such a simple issue could be fixed?
Yeah, we're fundamentally doing a lot of work around our waiting times and knowing that actually data quality and things like little nuances and annoyances like that can actually delay further. So there is a big programme within CPFT where we're looking to really work hard to make sure that people are getting access to their care as quickly as possible. So that will be being picked up in the patient journey programme, which is one of our golden threads.
Thank you. Councillor Keogh.
Thank you, Chair. As a GP, I just want to say that it is so difficult trying to get in touch with a first response service when you press NHS 111 option 2. I've had to call you twice, unfortunately, over the last 3 weeks, and each and every time, on one occasion, I was told that I needed to send the patient to A&E, who was sat in front of me. And on the second occasion, I refused to send the patient to A&E because hospital is on critical alert. I don't think it's fair that patients are sent to a setting where they're having to wait. I cannot take ownership over that patient's journey and the risk that they're exposed to, especially if they're alone. And I had to wait for a significant time after the practice had finished for a first response responder to come and assess them. In the report, you've got some beautiful data about meeting targets above 99% or 90% when you visit patients in A&E and at the hospital. What data do you have about GP services? Because that's where the problem is, and that is where it needs fixing, so that we can have put that cog in the wheel and prevent those waiting times at A&E. Because as you know, mental health patients in crisis use a lot of resources. So we've got the constabulary that are involved, we've got the ambulance services that are involved as well. But if we just got that bit right, I believe that we could improve the service quite significantly. Thank you.
So I think fundamentally we do have a primary care service, so we do have some data around that. In terms of accessing crisis service, which would be different to the primary care service, so that's one of the areas that I did talk about. We are really, really struggling significantly because the referral numbers have risen by 44% during COVID, which means our ability to respond to all of those people that are calling and to triage and to get out to the most risky, most vulnerable people on those calls is an ever challenging problem. And I think in terms of if somebody turns up to A&E and we have a national target of to respond within an hour, and that's funded accordingly because that's part of the long-term plan with the liaison psychiatry. So I think I understand that I wouldn't necessarily be able to comment on the specific clinical rationale for each of the cases. It may well have been that actually that person in good intention is saying that they are likely to be seen by liaison psychiatry within an hour if they went to A&E, which is not in the system. It doesn't seem to make sense, but it's thinking about that particular patient at the time because of the demand that is that, and we're trying to do some work around our first response service so that we answer as quickly as possible because some of the waits are unacceptable and we know that. So I do apologise for that.
I think we honestly recognise that the staff are under a phenomenal amount of pressure, so please don't apologise. But I just think that if we were to implement a similar liaison psychiatry service, or even depending upon funding, if you sort of steered the compass a little bit towards primary care, where the bulk of crisis related conditions are, I think we would see those wheels turn. So it's just a suggestion and positive sort of criticism. I know it's difficult, but thank you.
I honestly don't disagree with you. And it was a conversation I had, which was pre-COVID, when I went to a meeting with NHS England, that actually if we put good waiting time targets of an hour within A&E, that will become the new front door for services. And that's not where we want to be. And actually, unfortunately, that's where the funding comes from, the national programme. So it would be really useful to have the same level of response so that we're not having to send people that way. So I do recognise that and trying to influence as best we can to make sure that we can make that difference.
Thank you. Eva Woods.
Thank you, Chair. So my question relates to page 22, where we're seeing some data about the rates of young people referred for eating disorder treatment and the speed at which they're able to access that treatment. My question comes from a comment that I hear a lot from young people, which is this fear of when seeking eating disorder treatment, not being sick enough, so not meeting weight thresholds or not having the right symptom patterns. And I wonder whether the data exists for young people who have tried to get a referral either through their GP or through their school and have been denied that because of not reaching thresholds. So I wonder whether it's possible to get that data either to alleviate young people's fears and show them that actually this isn't a problem, or to confirm the realness of this and create policy towards it.
Yeah, I'm happy to take that away and get some more detailed information for you around access to eating disorders for young people. I don't have that data with me now, but I'm happy for us to bring that back.
Thank you. Councillor Skipstead.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions. One is relating to 4.1.2, where you mentioned that there is no counselling for adults. I just wanted to ask, does not provide adult counselling service, but have approved psychological therapy services. So what you're saying is there's no one-to-one counselling for adults, and if so, is that what you want it to be, or is it because of funding, or just what is that desirable? Is that, you know, is that where you want it to be, or is it because we have constraints of funding and so on?
I think it's more about the semantics of modality. So we have psychological therapy services, and the improving access to psychological therapy services, where we have got the data, which is a one-to-one therapy, is nationally mandated and quite heavily funded. So there is psychological therapies, but it's not classed. It's not counselling. Isn't the modality that's nationally prescribed, but people will have access to. They can have through the service, they can have 6 weeks or 21 weeks, so low intensity or high intensity counselling, CBT based, but there are lots of different modalities, but they cluster it as the psychological therapies as opposed to purist counselling.
Sure.
Another question which is separate from that, it's about focus on SEND in adult mental health. Is there likely to be a better focus on that, as there is in CAMHS, particularly because you've got an increasing number of children and young people with more complex needs and mental health needs moving into the adult services? And on that, what work is taking place to ensure that a person-centred approach that you have in CAMHS is modelled in adult mental health services, especially for adults with multiple diagnoses, for example, and including autism? Thank you.
So in terms of children and children moving into adult services, so strategically there is the crossover between children's and adults goes up to 25 now. So what we're trying to do is make sure that there is a greater level of transition of services rather than cutting off at 18. So strategically and policy wise, there are a lot of things coming on board around what we need to do up to the 25 cohort. In terms of people with complex needs, for example, and you sort of said about if somebody has autism as well as some other things, so we will always try as best as can to treat the needs of the individual. So it might be that they would sit within the primary diagnosis, but then we would reach in experts into that team to support the individual to make sure that the certainly from a medication perspective, that medications aren't counterintuitive for each other, but we do try it. Well, we do aim to have a very person-centred approach around assessment and ensuring that we're meeting the needs, and not just from a health perspective, but working with our social care colleagues as well.
Thank you. Councillor Farouk.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the report. It's just regarding item 4.2.4, waiting times. I've noticed you've mentioned that the team has added increased availability of appointments by adding Saturday working through February and March 2023. And if we've got any indication of how this has fared in addressing the backlog of those waiting. And then on the other side of the coin, how has this added service being delivered? Is it sort of through challenging the already stretched workforce that we have, or is it through agency working or additional staff?
I think that's one I would have to go back and ask the specific team around in terms of how they're managing that. Workforce is, it, like I say, has been an issue for us, but we are also looking at ways that we can attract staff, which is about offering flexible times for people to come in. So actually being able to offer weekend working for people is certainly part of one of our initiatives to support, and also making sure that we're able to deal with the backlog and the impact of COVID. But if there's, from the specifics that you've asked, I can make sure we bring that information back.
Thank you. And co-opted member Sandy Burns, please.
Thank you. Just going back to the 91% of the people that are seen within 1 hour at A&E, is that from them arriving at A&E and then it's an hour, or is that from when they wait and then get assessed and then get referred?
That's from the point that we know about them. So that will, that could be ultimately when they arrive at A&E, there will be a level of triage. If there is a physical health presentation that needs to be addressed first, so for example, if somebody has taken an overdose, what we would talk about is that that person would need to be physically cleared, so the physical health issue would need to be addressed first, and then from that point, then they're referred to us, we would see them within an hour of that referral to us.
So can I just clarify, so if they're in crisis and they're, for want of a better word, having a meltdown when they get to A&E, do they just have to sit and wait like everyone else?
I think if the what we will also do, and our teams that are based in A&E in the hospital, they do a lot of work with the staff there about supporting people in a crisis. So you don't always necessarily need to have somebody who's specially trained. So sometimes just being able to support and calm somebody down. If any of the teams, if somebody arrived and there was some significant concerns about the mental well-being, our team work in partnership with the A&E department, so they would be available to support and offer help and advice.
Thank you.
Eva Woods.
Thank you. So my question relates to page 31, where details given on some of the prevention activities being undertaken. I see personal development materials are being provided to schools to support the development of resilience skills. I wonder how the efficacy of these is being tested and reviewed, and whether impact on incident rates of mental health issues is being monitored in young people, and the impact these curriculum resources are having.
I don't think I know the answer to that question. I can certainly go away and ask the team. I think it would be difficult to pinpoint a specific activity and whether that in isolation would have an impact when there are a lot of things that are happening, not just from us but from our partners as well, to try and to help educate people within schools. But I can certainly go and ask to see what is being collated around that.
Thank you. Any more questions, members? Councillor Elsie.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going back to 4.2.4, the waiting times. Table 3 shows that the worst case scenario was 34, then you went down to ones and zeros, and you've now jumped to 7, which, whilst 7 isn't a particularly big number in its own right, is a third of the worst figure that you had, more or less, and is quite seismic in terms of going from 0 to 7 in space of a couple of months. So is the first part of my question is there a reason for that? The second part is that the next table down, which is number of young CYP waiting for mental health assessment, your peak was 2,500, your start point was 1,800, you're still at 1,900, even though it's considered a current low. if that's where you are, and if the people who are waiting more than 52 weeks has leapt in the way that it has, and I'm not being dramatic, but it's a fairly big number, and you think that a way of mitigating that is to have Saturday working, is there a reason why the Saturday working hasn't come in a lot sooner than now?
I think Saturday working was probably part of a solution. There is also a lot of other things that we've been doing to try and reduce the waiting times and to ensure that we've got as low as we can. And sometimes in terms of we can have people, some of the reduction in waiting times can be around data quality. So if we give you, for example, that we can have sometimes that somebody's on a clinical system as waiting, but they're not actually waiting, and so somebody might not have, you know, they might have moved house or they've moved area, but the referral has not been closed. So there's a data quality piece of work that we had to do as well. So some of the dip in the waits has also been around about data quality piece of work as well. And then in terms of like numbers going up, so we do have times of the year where there are where people have got the referrals would go up, and it could also be related to when they go up, you know, if there has been a sort of significant turnover of staff, so if staff are moving on or leaving. In terms of a deep dive into what's happening with the waits, a recommendation I could suggest is, as I say, the waiting times programme is part of our part of one of our sort of golden threads that we're trying to do to address, and whether it'd be useful to bring back a bit more of a detailed piece of work to the committee to talk about what we're doing specifically around waiting lists and what we find from that piece of work, which might help answer the questions more robustly.
Thank you. That would be helpful if you could do that.
Thank you. Councillor Robinson.
Thank you. So my question kind of follows on from that and Eva's question about table 4 on page 22, proportion waiting for CAMS eating disorder assessment. Now I just need to double check that I'm reading the table correctly, because we were all a little confused in the pre-meeting. Are those figures the percentage seen on time or have I misunderstood? But anyway, so the crux of the question is, I see that only sort of 42 young people a year. Well, actually, not only that's an awful thing to think there are 42 people out there who need urgent eating disorder assessment. But are you able to outline what kind of pressures cause a delay, if that's only a few a month, as to why they're not seen? And as it's all gone up and down in those figures, can we look forward to a more kind of steady attainment of that target in the future?
So in answer to your first question, so the way I read this particular table, so what it's saying is, of the urgent referrals, so the requirement with urgence of how many need to be seen within 7 days, so that first line will say the percentage of people who need to be seen within 7 days were seen. So for example, if you look across that urgent bit for February 23, 67% of people who should have been seen within 7 days were seen within 7 days, and 87% of people who should have been seen within 28 days were seen within 28 days. That's how I read it. I think where they've tried to explain it in the paragraphs below, because it is small numbers, you can have one person or two people that miss the target and then it looks like we've completely dropped off. What they've done with those proportion of people that have missed the target, done a bit more of a deep dive into that, and sometimes not being seen can be about the availability of the patient themselves. So I know, and I can talk to this particularly from a piece of work that we did in adults around early intervention and psychosis, which is a similar, it's a smaller number. You can have one person that doesn't turn up and you can miss your national target within that time. When we can investigate it, that person might say, well, actually, can I be seen the week after, because this week doesn't work for me. From a recording perspective of when you receive the referral and when you offer the appointment, that's the very sort of the way it has to be recorded on the system, without the fact of being able to mitigate the narrative. So the piece of work we're doing around looking at the waiting times is to go into some of those where we've breached those waiting times and go, is there a fundamental process problem that we need to address, or is this because actually that patient has requested an appointment at a different time? And that gives us that level of quality assurance that we're not missing need in the way that would cause a problem for the patient.
Thank you. That's questions from members. I just have one, please, it's very brief. It's on page 17, the East of England Ambulance Service Trust. I just want to better understand the details in that section where you have the mental health nurse going along with the paramedics. And it shows here that there has been a reduction in the conveyances because of that. Does it seem like you're going to expand this across with the foundation, the NHS?
Yeah, so we had done some work, and the outcomes had been really good. So from a system perspective, we've been able to reduce the need to convey people. So actually it means that anybody with a mental health need is getting put in the right place rather than being taken to A&E, which is not necessarily the right place that they need to be. Sometimes as well, it can be about that nurse being able to offer an appropriate intervention that de-escalates the situation, allows that person to then for them to safely leave that situation with an ongoing plan in place. So we've currently, like I say, we've got a resource of that within East of England Ambulance. Our ICB has expanded that, and we're now moving into police cars as well. So we've got staff that are working in police cars. In terms of, it's still quite a small resource, but making a sizable impact. But it continues to be something that the Ambulance Trust and our system colleagues and our police colleagues are spending at jobs, which means that fundamentally they will then be able to respond to other calls quicker. So from a system perspective, it is something that very much people want to grow.
Absolutely, yes. So my thoughts on this was there is an expense of staffing fees for this person in the ambulance, but however there's labour benefits from saving them taking time in with service. At some point, would it be able to get the data so a potential saving attached to this particular role on the service, so that could better promote the benefits of it and help with expanding it?
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly speak with some of our ICB colleagues, because there will have that data will have probably gone through the system in order to make the case for further funding, and so I'm sure it's very much available. Like I say, if we were able to reduce the number of conveyance, sure. it's quite a, you could make a quite crude calculation based on the cost per, the unit cost per A&E attendance and the reduction of what
quite
would
sizable.
Have gone there. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. And just one finally, I'd like to ask this question. How could the committee help you with any of your challenges?
Can you find me staff, please?
Anybody want to volunteer?
No, I think it's just continuing to work with us around, I think ultimately as we all work together as a system, health and social care kind of means that we're better together and we're better for the patient or the member of our community. We don't necessarily separate out our issues, so that the more we can work together collectively, the stronger we'll be for our community.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you
for attending. Okay, team, I've got just to read out the recommendations. It's quite sizable, so just bear with me. So it's recommended that the Adults and Health Security Committee note that Cambridge and Peterborough NHS Foundation Trust is commissioned to provide secondary mental health services, specialist inpatient and community services for Cambridgeshire and Peterborough and across the east of England. CPFT is a key partner in the CMP integrated care system. As host organisation for the Mental Health, Learning Disability and Autism Accountable Business Unit. Not finished yet. Notes that challenges for CPFT reflect the national picture for increasing referrals to services, gaps in the workforce across a whole range of healthcare professions, and the impact of increasing costs of living. Do we agree to note that? Do you want to read them again? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. McCormick, for coming. Thank you, members, for the questions. So now we will go to what was item six, which is now, what was item five, now item six. Food environment within hospitals and hospital food trust standards. This is presented by Caroline Walker, Chief Executive, Northwest Anglia NHS Finance and Trust, and David Moss, Director for Estates and Facilities. Hi, thank you for coming. Would you like to introduce this or go straight to questions? It's up to you.
Hello, my name is Caroline. I'm Chief Executive of the Trust, and I've got colleague David Moss here, who's Director of Estates and Facilities. So, are you happy for me to go straight into the report?
Yes, please.
You've got the report in front of you. I'm going to just briefly introduce and take you through the content, and David can help answer any difficult questions or questions that we've got. So in line with the brief, hopefully the report's self-explanatory, we've taken you through the position for the Peterborough City Hospital site and articulated how the standards that there are eight of that we work towards in the NHS for our food standards within there. Hopefully that's self-explanatory. Through the report, we're making the point that the inpatient and the staff food at the Peterborough City Hospital is provided through an outsourced solution through Medirest, and a PFI contract provides that. Hopefully you've got a flavour for the provision and how we prepare our food and the provision that we provide. And one of the things that we were keen to articulate to you is how we get feedback on that food as well, and the quality of the food and how we monitor that. So the report takes you through that as well, and how we get patient and staff feedback relating to the food. One thing I will say that doesn't really jump out in the report is that we get very few complaints about food, which is surprising, really. So within that context of wanting to always get feedback and wanting to meet patients' needs and nutritional needs, we do get very few complaints about our food because of the provision that we do have. The report also takes you through how we benchmark against our food provision. David has got some figures on cost on that if you're interested in that, but we have an official process that the whole of the NHS use called the PLACE assessment that assesses our food provision against national standards, and there's a way of assessing within that, within a standard format that most hospitals use within that. So hopefully the rest of the report is self-explanatory. One of the questions that the committee asked was whether we'd won any awards or anything, and I have articulated that there aren't any awards that we've successfully nominated ourselves for or that we've won within the paper. So that's a quick overview from me. I'll ask David to add anything that he particularly wants to add about that. One thing that I will say, having said we don't get very many complaints about the hospital food, I don't get very many complaints actually at all about quite a lot of things, so that's a good yardstick. But one thing that has been an issue for us recently, sadly because of the waiting times in our A&E department, has been the provision of food in the A&E department. So it's something that we've had to respond to, and we have responded to. So that might be something that constituents and people that you speak to might have mentioned. If you imagine a short journey time in A&E, you wouldn't normally provide anything other than hot food, hot drinks and sandwiches or biscuits. But we've got some really long journey times in the A&E department at times at the moment. So we have changed our food provision to include hot food now. If patients are going to be in the department up to 12 hours, we've had to completely think about how we provide different food. And that's something that we started to get complaints about and realised we had to change. So we have tried to adapt to that. Hopefully we'll return to a position with short waiting times in our A&E department before too much longer, but it's something that we have thought about and taken on board feedback that we've had. Thank you. David, do you want to add anything?
Yes, thank you. So David Moss, Director of Estates and Facilities. Just two things really that I would add. Obviously the flow of patients through the hospital is very variable. So we have to remain as flexible as we can with the food service that we supply for our patients, and that mainly involves provision of food out of hours if necessary if people are waiting, and also we have a broad range of patients that come through the hospital that need feeding, Some, for example, maybe are elder patients which need to eat a lot of food high in calories so that they can make recovery. And other patients may have had an operation and not be able to have any food. So we have to be extremely flexible. We also have a broad range of cultural preferences around food, which we have to cater for. And the method of production that we use for food through simplicity, which is where, you know, meals are steamed, allows us to be very flexible and produce different menus to suit that specific patient. So I think that probably says why we don't get so many complaints. One of my other roles is I'm the vice chair of the Hospital Estates and Facilities Management Association. And one of the main complaints you get in hospitals is about the temperature of food, because food is delivered to patients and quite often patients need assistance in eating that meal. And the food is brought out, you know, mostly in bulk. And by the time the patients are fed, it is cold. Using the method that we do at Peterborough, it's more or less on demand. So patients get a hot meal, and that's one of the, you know, most common complaints that you find in hospitals, which is addressed through our food production techniques. I'm happy to take any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you for the introduction. Do you have any questions, members? Councillor Robinson.
Thank you, and thank you for your report, because I have to confess it was a topic I didn't really know anything about, so it's helped me understand how you operate and what you deliver. But on scrutiny, we always love to see things that are showing that a service is kind of onwards and upwards. So I know that you've described how you gather feedback from lots of different sources. Are you able to give us any headlines of things that came out of that and how you responded, and kind of for the year ahead, you know, what's your kind of target, what's your main focus for development to make things even better?
Yeah, so I mean, the best form of feedback is, as you say, listening to our patients and getting their feedback. And I think one of the things that we have done is change the menu frequently. So within the report, it says that we change the menu every 6 months, and we listen to patients' feedback and certainly what sort of foods that they would like to see on the menu. And again, you know, we have a lot of different patients, as I've mentioned. So for example, the children that are in hospital would certainly probably not wish to see the same food that the adults do. So we've done exercises where we've listened to children and tried to put nutritious and things they want to eat on there. For example, you know, it could be nuggets and things like that rather than shepherd's pie, for example. So we try and cater for a broad range of patients. And as you say, you know, the aim is for continuous improvement. And obviously, you know, there are, shall we say, challenges in the food supply chain, which we also have to adapt to. And I think one of the other elements that comes out as well, which is very common, is around sustainability in food as well. So things that we can do about reducing waste and looking at potentially some parts of the food that's served that can be produced on site from local sources as well. So sustainability is another factor where we are particularly looking to grow and improve as well.
Thank you. Councillor Elsie.
Thank you and welcome. It says on the first page that the rate standards that you are required to meet. My question is on the first of those, which is that organisations must have a food and drink strategy. I just wondered if you could give me what your headlines are in terms of your food and drink strategy and how you measure against that strategy in terms of success.
Yes, certainly. So, I mean, the food and drink strategy, obviously this deals with, you know, we work very closely with dietitians to make sure that the food gives the patients the nutritions that they need, particularly for, you know, patients, for example, with dementia. It could be patients, for example, that can't swallow. So we work very, very closely with dieticians. Generally, the drink strategy as well is making sure that patients always have access to water and are kept hydrated. Because if food and drink aren't supplied to the patients, then you know that can delay prolong their stay in hospital. So again, it's treating food and drink almost as a medicine for the patients, and making sure that we can assist them in getting better and getting home as quickly as possible.
And how do you feel that how do you measure your success against that? So if that's what your strategy is, how do you measure whether or not you're actually fulfilling those requirements, you're surpassing them? Subsidiary question as a consequence of something you said. You talk about people who can't eat. So do you have all five stages of dysphagia food?
So the first point to your question, I think is how we measure our success is the food and drink strategy would have an annual review, and within the corporate governance structure that we have, we take updates on our implementation of that strategy, and make sure it reflects any changes in guidance or any further improvements. And within there, we will have a series of actions and key performance indicators that we'll be able to measure. We also benchmark against other organisations to see if there is any best practice that we can learn from as well. I'm not clinical, so I probably couldn't answer the questions you had on dysphagia, but that's something that we can look at.
We do have an approach to patients with difficulties and different types of drink and food and nutrition for them, so it's part of what we do, just as we do for patients with diabetes or other conditions as well that we have to adjust the diet for, and the frail elderly as well, who might be on liquid diets.
Caroline, just for a note, if you do want to speak, please turn your microphone on. Thank you. Finished? Okay, thank you. Councillor Keown.
Thank you, Chair. I'm aware that you've already spoken about being culturally and have taken religious backgrounds of patients into account as well. I'm often faced with having to admit patients and them saying, we are not going in because we don't like the food. And we live in a very culturally diverse city. And would you like to elaborate a little bit on what cultural sort of variety that you offer, please? Thank you.
Yes, certainly. I think part of this is there is often a preconception about hospital food, which I don't think, is true these days. We encourage people to try our hospital food, we have initiatives where the board have tried the food as well. I've tried the food, and it is, I think it's very good. It's not a hotel by any means, but at the same time, the food is good. We cater for, different varieties. We might have kofta, we have halal. We have lots of different menus. The company that we use is Compass, who supply the food. They are a huge global business with a £21 billion market cap, I believe. So they have a very, very extensive menu and cater for those. So I am not aware of any complaints we've had recently about people being unable to get the right food that suits their cultural beliefs.
Thank you. Just out of complete interest, is your canteen food for the staff exactly the same as what you give to the patients as well?
So it isn't, because of the way it's produced. So the meals for patients effectively are steamed and are ready in a portion. The food that's produced in the restaurant, again, is produced in a similar way to, for example, as you would do in a restaurant where it's produced and cooked in a kitchen. We haven't got the facilities to cook for patients on that same basis. It would require a significant change to how the hospital operates to do that.
The canteen food is really good. I've eaten it. My husband works there. So, yeah. Well, not in the canteen, but yeah. The chicken curry is great.
Any other questions, councillors? Councillor Farouk.
Thank you, Chair. And it was just touching on the 8 standards that the NHS organisations are required to meet, which is what Councillor Elsie touched on. In particular, number 7, about demonstrating that you provide suitable 24/7 food service. And I just wanted to clarify whether, say, in the middle of the night, 2, 3 a.m., if not, you know, not your hospital per se, but if a hospital, the only food they were offering at that time was through vending machines, whether that satisfies that standard?
Yeah, certainly. So we have 2 facilities, one in the women and children area and also one in the main restaurant where people can, it's not actually, you know, crisps and chocolate, it's a meal from a vending machine, and you can then warm that meal up so people can have a hot meal 24/7. As in regard to patients, the food, the nurses will be able to access either snack boxes or sandwiches for people, because we can't plan when people are admitted or when the last time was that they ate. So we generally have flexibility and the means of offering food 24/7.
Thank you. I have some questions on this one. The actual request for this to come to committee wasn't necessarily that there was any complaints in the system. It was an observation that a patient made about a contradiction attached to NHS advice for the food offering on the menus. So, for example, the note on the website regards to consumption of bread and processed meats and its correlation to colorectal cancer, for example. The amounts on the website dictate you would reduce or only eat a small amount, but the menu contradicts that by offering a larger amount, and it states don't have too many sausages and bacon, for example. It shows the grams of the offering, but the menu offers more than that. So, and it even offers full English breakfast, for example, which contradicts the advice. And the Eat Well chart on the website also attached the diabetes analysis, obesity, but we're still offering these products, which contradicts the advice that the NHS is giving. So I wanted some feedback on that, and I can give examples if you need it from websites. One I've not wanted to share, I know, for example, smoking isn't permitted in the hospital because it's category 1 carcinogenic properties, but processed meat is the same category, but we're still offering that product. I know there are cultural issues attached to food, it's a tricky scenario, but as a hospital, would it not be prudent to offer evidence-based food, which is, and you use the terminology, food as medicine, but we're actually offering them food which is not necessarily medicine because there is evidence to show that it's correlation to other diseases. Thank you.
I come in there. I think that's a fair point, actually, and a fair challenge that we should look to respond to. But it's back to some of the food is medicine. Sometimes when people are vulnerable and trying to recover from illnesses, any food is better than no food, and nutrition sometimes. People are not generally in hospital for a long time, are they? So there's a mix of different things that are come into play. And the example David gave there was of the children in the hospital being encouraged to eat anything, and possibly being encouraged to eat foods that are treat foods like ice cream or chicken nuggets and things. So there's conflicting opinions on how to entice people to eat when they've been in a vulnerable situation and recovering from illness. So, but I think it's a fair challenge to think about those things as the same sort of category as smoking or other things that might be more obviously linked to other health risks, really.
So the message is confusing. If the website is stating one thing, but the food offer in the hospital is stating another, then which message is correct? And what is the patient to do if the advice given isn't then followed by the hospital itself? The medical practitioners. So in turn, are they going to be able to take that advice on board and change their potential lifestyle for food as medicine, or would they just continue as they are, which could be causing the illness in the first place, for example?
So I think part of it as well is, again, catering for the broad range of patients that we have. For example, if we have, you know, an elderly person with dementia that isn't necessarily eating and just needs some calories, then we have, you know, for example, sponge puddings on the menu with a high calorie intake, which is something, you know, that they need. And we have other patients that would only eat specific foods that they know and have eaten traditionally for a long time. And I think, you know, getting them to eat that food is important, which is why we try and focus on having a broad range of food available for a broad range of patients and trying to cater for them all. And I think, you know, taking on board what you say about, for example, the processed meats and things, you know, we do have, you know, vegan, we do have vegetarian dishes, and they are growing in popularity, you know, in particular with the younger generations. So I think the menu will change and adapt as society and culture changes as well. But certainly we will take that feedback back about the processed meats.
Can I just add the point linked to the kind of the longevity of this? Our average patient length of stay is something like 4.6 days. So the time that a patient's in the hospital on average is 4.6 days. So the long-term health implications of some of the eating isn't the most material factor. It's their recovery from the condition that they're in the hospital for as well. But I think it's a fair challenge for us to think about some of those things and promote some of the plant-based, vegan or vegetarian options as well. Thank you.
Sure. It's just reference to education. So when patient does arrive, are they educated with potential risks of the food that they're being offered, for example? And I know you state about longevity. They still don't then recommend having a cigarette if they'd smoke, even if they're in hospital for one day. But yeah, if it's in the same category from the World Health Organization as a carcinogenic property, we still say that's okay. So there's a contradiction as the met is what I'm trying to point out here, which someone shared with me, so I thought I'd ask the question. It needs highlighting, and then in turn, looking at, could we offer shared information against the risks for food that is being offered, so then they're more informed of what choices to choose. In turn, they might only be offered for a short amount of time, but again, that food product could be a factor with relating to a potential cause of whatever people illnesses are suffering from, for example, like colorectal cancer or obesity, diabetes, for example, heart disease, which is the biggest killer in Peterborough as well. And then in turn, there's lots of saturated fats, oil food products like cheese, cheddar cheese, which on their website says don't have because it reduces cholesterol. But in turn, a lot of the products offer a lot of those food ingredients. Thank you.
There's a bigger public health agenda in what you're talking about, isn't there? Not just the food that's eaten inside hospitals.
Sure. Yeah. Need to start somewhere, I guess.
But the contradiction that you're referencing is a fair one.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Without no more questions, and thank you very much for coming. Just to note the information provided regarding hospital food and food standards for the purpose of compliance update. Thank you. Okay, item number 7, Adult Social Care Annual Complaints Report 21-22. Belinda Evans, who's the compliant manager, will be presenting the report. If you'd like to do so, please. Hi, Belinda, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Is this coming on the
bottom? One in the middle.
There we go. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Good evening. I'm here to present the annual report for complaints following adult social care statutory complaints process during the year 21-22. Adult social care complaints make up a small percentage of the work of the central complaints team, where we manage complaints about all council services. The responsibility for investigating and responding to complaints remains with managers in the individual social care teams within adult social care. My team monitor the delivery of complaint responses, keeping customers updated about progress and chasing service managers to urge that they respond within the required deadlines. The complaints we receive about adult social care mostly come in to us by email, but we're seeing an increasing number of complaints for the service received via telephone, an increase to 42% of the complaints received in the year in question, against 30% the previous year. This is going to be reviewed further this year to see if this shift has continued and why. Points I'd like to highlight in the actual report are that complaint numbers have continued to fall for a third year in succession. There's been an increase in the percentage of complaints where fault was some fault was found, but because of the decline in numbers in the number of cases, the actual number of upheld cases has fallen from 32 the previous year to 30 in 21-22. Only one adult social care complaint was investigated by the Ombudsman in 21-22 against four the previous year. So those are the highlights in the report, and I hope you found the report of interest, and I'd welcome any of your questions.
Thank you, Belinda. Any questions, members? Easy one. What do we do tonight? Councillor Skipstead.
Go on then. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to ask you, at the beginning of the report, you say that the amount of compliments has gone down.
Yes.
I just sort of wondered about that. What do you think that's about? That was one question. And also, the particular complaints, like if you don't want to do that one first, I'll ask the other one afterward. Thank you.
Yeah, we are quite disappointed that we're not capturing as many compliments. I think it's down to a number of factors. I think there's been some reorganisation within teams, etc. So we've got some managers that are covering two councils still at the moment, and you know the process of recording compliments has not been shared with them. So we're receiving quite a few at the end of the year where they've forgotten to put them through the process. So we've recently made all the services managers aware of how they should be responding to compliments, where they should be recording them, and what a compliment looks like, so that not only compliments from members of the general public, but also compliments from external professionals who might compliment workers that they've had some dealings with in regard to a case, that's also a compliment, and we record those as internal compliments rather than external compliments. So it is one area that we need to move back up. And we've always used in other council services, you know, that comparison between the number of complaints we get and the number of compliments we get, which we always want to see the balance in favour of compliments. And the number of complaints in adult social care are very low compared to a lot of other councils in the eastern region. But we also want to see our compliments up high. But we get some really good ones, and I hope that I've illustrated that in the report.
Thank you. I had just one other one. Sounds like okay.
Sure.
Yeah. It was just relating to the most complaints were to do with contracts and external providers.
Mm.
Is that because it's external and there's a sort of a mismatch between what's needed, and is it because it's external that's caused the fact that they're the ones that get the most complaints?
I think it's because of the services that they're providing to people. It, you know, it's everyday life. It could be affecting their, you know, meal times, their, you know, medication delivery, you know, what time they get taken out of bed in the morning, getting washed, etc. So it's really fundamental stuff, and I think that's why we get complaints about that more often than we do about maybe an assessment being late or something that's just a one-off issue rather than something that's repeated for that family or that customer. That's my view.
And what can be done about that, do you think?
Well, one of the things that we need to make sure of when contracts are let to new agencies is that they have a complaints process and they make it really clear that that's available to people, because what we don't know is how many complaints are being made to those service providers direct. I don't get to see that information, but people can make complaints directly with their service provider. But some people choose to come to the council, either because they haven't been made aware of that or because they don't feel that they trust that service enough to take the complaint forward, so they have the right to come to us. So the contracts teams make sure that they cover that off when a contract is first granted to a new organisation, but it's a case of making sure, monitoring that that is being used and it's effective and it's being made available to new customers when they're signed up, sort of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor Allen, please.
Thank you. You've given some examples of service improvements from complaints. There's one that says you've implemented a manual timesheet process at the request of a service user rather than the phone app. Is this just one particular, is it an exception that you've made for one user, or is that a whole service provider that you've done this for?
This was a particular complaint about an agency that there was a disagreement between the agency and the service user about what times the calls were being made, and because the care workers were updating their call times on an app that the company provides, the service user wanted to be able to make their own recording of when they believed that they arrived and left, etc. So that was just put in place so that there could be that correlation between the two sets of recordings. So it was a one-off.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor B. Councillor Skipstead, can you turn your microphone, please?
Thank you. Page 47, where it, 4.8, where it says delays in arranging respite care, delays in communication from social workers, and there's quite a few examples below that as well. Is that all due to staff shortage, or why were these delays, and how are you dealing with these now?
It's not something I could answer. Debbie's obviously somebody within the service. I don't work within adult social care, so I wouldn't know the reasons behind that. What we do is capture the reason that was given in the complaint response to the customer. So I don't know if Debbie wants to answer that.
Yeah, it is working. So we look into all of those delays, and it does, the demand on services does fluctuate. So we don't have a particular issue around vacancies for our social workers. We're quite successful in Peterborough that we're able to not only recruit but retain our staff. So often it is just about managing that demand, high caseloads, etc. And in many cases, the delays can be avoided, and that's part of our learning process. So thankfully, given the number of contacts we have on an annual basis and the number of people we support, it's a very low number, but we, regardless of the small number, we will address individual complaints with, directly with workers if that's what we need to do, which we've done.
Thank you. Co-opted member Sandy Burns, please.
Thank you. I don't always see complaints as a bad thing. I think people should be really encouraged to do that. But we find with our clients, they're frightened to make complaints about what they see as a statutory service. So they wouldn't complain against GPs, and they won't complain against care workers that are getting them up, washed and dressed, because they feel it's inevitable. What can be done to find out what they're actually feeling without having to go through a formal complaint situation?
So one of the things that the service do that I'm aware of is that they do a survey. Debbie might tell me the frequency of that, but I think it's 6 monthly or annually, and they get a lot of feedback from service users and their families about how they're experiencing services. So that's one way. But if they're one of the reasons why we get complaints, I think, from service users about their care providers is because they feel more comfortable coming to the council than they do addressing it with that individual that might be coming into their home, and they don't want to have that confrontation, or they're worried about the that person taking offence. One of the things within the adult social care statutory process that's very important is that when we get a complaint, we have to get consent to share that complaint. So it's different from all the other complaints processes. So it's not only that we have to have consent from the right person that we're accessing their data, etc., but we have to get consent to share. So very often we have to involve the care agency. We get a lot of complaints that are combined with NHS services, and we might be going to that NHS service to share that complaint, but we have to get consent to do that first, because otherwise we might put them in a vulnerable position, and that's why that requirement is within that statutory process.
Thank you.
Okay. Councillor Robinson, please.
Thank you. So my kind of question is about the procedure as a whole, really. So, and the way that, like you said, complaints can drive sort of service improvement. And it's just struck me, which I don't know why it didn't when you intended to do the same report for children's services, about the role of members. So often we'll get emails from residents who are unhappy about the sort of services listed here, and of course we forward those to the right officer because we're trying to help them find a solution. But I don't think I've ever suggested to anyone, actually, why don't you also put that on the complaints form online? So I wonder about if you actually feel that would be useful, and if members were reminded that when service users point out problems, as well as of course rushing to help fix them, that we should ensure they're logged. But of course you're just going to thank me next year if the numbers triple because everyone does it that way. But it's just crossed my mind if you felt actually that's a development point.
It's really important. I think that, you know, you asked earlier about how can the committee help our service, and that is to make sure that residents know about the complaints processes that they can access. I mean, there's a web form on the website, but they can ring our team. And as I said earlier, that for adult social care complaints, that seems to be an increasing medium of way into our service. But we do get complaints from counsellors for constituents, for adult social care, for children's social care, and for other council services, and we're quite happy to take them that way. If we're introduced to a situation by a councillor, we'll often ring that customer to make sure we understand their complaint fully, and then we can ask the customer if they want the councillor to be notified of the outcome as well as themselves. So we do often have that, but the more information that's out there about it, and the more reminding that that's happening, the better, because we like the low numbers, but we want to make sure that they're valid. You know, that's a valid representation of how many complaints there are out there.
Thank you. Just a couple for me, Belinda. You alluded earlier that Peterborough's numbers are lower than some other potential comparative councils. Do you have that? Do you have those numbers?
I don't have them here.
Sure.
But I can certainly
capture them.
Would it be
possible then to add it on future reports, those comparative numbers, so we know where we sit?
Yeah.
Everything's comparable, so it's okay saying we're low, but we'd like to see that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd ask you what sort of comparisons, because where I get my data from is I'm part of the Eastern Region Complaint Managers Group, which includes a lot of county councils, district councils, unitary councils. So it's a case of I can bring those figures forward, but some of them don't bear any resemblance to our service because we're a unitary. So for example, in Cambridgeshire, you know, the numbers are significantly higher, and that might not, I might not have the comparisons of how many customers they deal with in that service to look at the percentage, if that makes sense. So in our service, we're looking at, I think, can't remember, it's in the report, about 2,500.
Well, when you said it's low compared to the count, which ones are you comparing it to?
So for example, Milton Keynes, which is a very comparable council, I did a comparison study with them a couple of years ago, which included adults, children's and corporate complaints. We were very level at that time, and since then their complaint numbers have gone up since then, and have all the other councils in the region. But our numbers have gone down. So I'm not saying that you know, what we started off at was comparable, but we're going down. The other councils I speak to are going up.
I'm sure you're able to find out.
Yeah, I can certainly provide numbers, but I'm not sure
In other scenarios, they do compare, for example, Luton or Doncaster, for example.
Yeah.
They're similar
population
sizes.
Pull up unitary councils, for example.
Sure.
But
it'd be good
help.
To see how we compare.
Yeah.
Because what is low compared to what could be high,
yeah.
we don't know. So give us some numbers is all the question.
Yeah.
One, I may be misreading it here, apologies. At the beginning of the report, it states, I just had the page number momentarily, forgive me, I did catch the page. It states, well, I think it was 66 complaints in 21-22. But then further down on complaints received, section 4.3, page 44, it says there were 42 complaints in 21-22. What's the difference? Am I misreading this, or what's the difference in those numbers?
Where did you see the other figure?
69. Further up the page, I'm just going to scale down to it. So, page 42, section 4.1, complaints received.
That's compliments.
Oh, there you go. Thank you very much for clarifying it.
So there were 66.
I thought I was misreading something.
Compliments and the 40.
Complimented on your reading skills. Okay, any more questions at all from members? Thank you for coming, Belinda. Appreciate your time for that. I need to read out the recommendation then, team. We need to note the summary of the adult social care statutory complaints and compliments received between 1st of April 21 and 31st of March 22, and the learning and actions taken as a result. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Belinda. Moving on to item number 8, Mental Health Section 75 Partnership Agreement Annual Report, to be presented by Gurdev Singh, Head of Commissioning Adult Social Care. Very welcome to introduce when you are ready, sir.
Thank you, Chair. So this is the Mental Health Section 75 Partnership Agreement Annual Report. I'd like to point out to members, starting paragraph 4.2, which talks about the expenditure at approximately £1.4 million per annum, with likelihood of in the next financial year of a potential increase if we develop a business case to improve in employment-related services. Further on in paragraph 4.3, the members should note the two key metrics that we draw out there, where employment is at below target, so below comparator sites, whereas the accommodation-related metric is slightly above comparator sites. And further down into 4.5, where we talk about the volume of activity, as well as the financial sections in 4.5.1 and 4.5.2, both indicate a growing level of demand, but also an increase in expenditure above current plans. So for the first three quarters of this year, we're currently running at about just under £600,000 above plan. And furthermore, in 4.7, members should note some examples of feedback we're getting on the quality of service delivered, which probably helps support the fact that the accommodation-based metric is at a better situation compared to the employment side. And then finally, in 4.8, the priorities for the forthcoming year particularly focus on trying to improve the mix of staff available, as well as the wider network of staff available for people supporting mental health services, and to try and improve on some of the improvements we made this year by stabilising and growing the brokerage service, which is an example of a service where we are matching an individual to a particular service and improving the speed of the referral pathway through. Thank you, Chair. So I'll take questions.
Thank you. Questions from members? Do we have any? Okay.
Could stop there.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Thank you. Is there anything else you wanted to share at all, or was that it?
Well, just one point, actually. I'm just picking up the point you've asked the other.
You can divide your own questions if you wish and answer them for you.
No, it's just taking the opportunity saying whenever members get the chance to promote the services of mental health service and practitioners in particular, and also across other committees, whether or not there are work being done to improve availability of both staff, of accommodation, and the wider awareness of the need to support mental health patients and service users in the community, just as every other ordinary person is.
How would you suggest we do that?
Just by way of whether it's through scrutiny or through membership of other committees, just drawing out those points, that's all.
Okay, thank you. All right. Okay, so we need to... Of course, go ahead.
While we're all here, especially as we have a GP in the room, it might be of help. It's to do with mental health. So far, I've read quite a few items in there that show lots of different ways of getting help. From a counsellor's point of view, or just from a parent or whatever, is my best way, because it's quite confusing, is it just to go to the GP? If somebody rings me up and says I've got, or I'm struggling in some way, there's things like 111, and then they refer you there, and it's all this sort of thing. And there'll be other people who are probably waiting 2 or 3 weeks for an appointment with a doctor who's got the same problem. So I don't know if you can help this. How do we make sure that our families, our friends, our constituents, where do we send them first point of call?
Yes. GP colleagues in the room as well for help here.
Okay. Well, no, actually there is a very... So the psychological wellbeing service, if you find that a loved one or a friend or a relative isn't severely depressed, then you can self-refer to the psychological wellbeing service that's part of the CPFT sort of arm. However, anything more than that, then you would have to go to your GP to have an assessment. But I believe when we're talking about adult social care, the role of social prescribers has now become more and more useful, obviously, as Debbie, I think, will be able to endorse, because social prescribers, you know, organisations like PCVS, for example, are doing an awful lot in aligning social prescribers with particular PCNs, which are an amalgamation of GP surgeries. And those can be accessed through adult social care as well as through primary care or your GP services as well. And they do a fabulous job of addressing things like social mobility, for example, or social isolation. And sometimes it's a matter of, say, for example, a vulnerable adult or somebody who's living alone, just to have that little bit of reassurance. And it helps in empowering them as well to feel good about themselves, or just to do simple tasks such as the shopping or getting the odd mail posted. So social prescribers, I found, are an incredibly powerful tool and can be accessed via either adult social care, PCVS, or through your GP. So these are the various spheres, but it would depend upon the individual's need as well.
Sorry to push the point, but that's the problem, isn't it? I have no idea what their individual need is. Do you see where I'm coming from? So I met a lady, it's just a coincidence. I met a lady last weekend who spotted me, knew I was the counsellor, cried on my shoulder about an issue. And all I thought was, well, I can say, have you seen your doctor? Now I've come to this, I've heard a lot of different ways she could have done it. But I'm still confused as to how I've left her with to see a doctor. Now I'm still in touch with her. But if there's a better route, you know, I'd like to use that route. And for anybody who comes forward who says, I've got an issue. Now, am I a medical expert can say, well, actually, I think you're suffering from depression or whatever, because I don't know. She's just upset. It's clearly a mental. She said, I've been diagnosed with a mental illness. I won't go into what that is, but obviously, so there's something. I just wondered where I go with it, really.
I think that's such a valid point. In fact, I'd like to share with my colleague counsellors a resource called, if you Google it, I'm just trying to find the... So it's known as keepyourhead.com. Have you heard of it? It's got all the resources for mental health for both adults and children as well, and local services, support services, especially for those affiliated with adult social care who have adult social care. And it's a great website that I'm using all the time. And I share that with my counsellors as well. So if you have someone, like you've said, again, the question arises whether the resident in question is also computer literate, because sometimes we will have elderly residents that are. But for yourself, I think in terms of signposting, it's a useful tool to have on hand to gain access to and say, do you know what? I found a couple of numbers for you that might be useful. And you can use that for them as well. I've certainly used it quite a lot of times outside my GP role, and it's been very helpful. So that is keep-your-head.com. And you've got adults and children there.
Yeah, so this is an opportunity for members to ask for any additional information on any items relevant for this committee. The relevant items for this committee have been highlighted. The latest version of our plan was sent to members on 13th of March, yesterday. If you have got any questions or any...
Sorry, can I have got a question? Here on page number 64, you've got the disposal of land and buildings in Eastwood. I'm not sure if I'm missing any. All right, okay, sorry. I
thought it's all of them across everybody. 64.
Okay,
just
the highlight.
Just the highlight, yeah.
Is that correct? Do you want to go for page individually, or should I take them as there are no questions? Okay, all right. Then that is it. Thank you for attending.